He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys.
Good morning to this week's listener group on Car Keys with Mike, Jay, and Robin. We are in the springtime of 2025 for this show, and there are various things going on as spring gets into our Northwest Connecticut corner that I would like to bring up and Jay would like to bring up for our listeners today. We have been talking on many, well, several previous shows or shows coming up to this one about tariffs and whether we worry about them or not. And there's two sides to every story, so we won't get into that a whole lot more. Some buyers, as I mentioned in an earlier show, have run out to buy cars thinking that they're going to rise instantly in price as of April 2nd, which is just after this show was done. And others are just waiting, and advice is all over the map of whether we should tell you to rush out and buy them or not, and so we won't say anything in this show further about that. But it's going to be interesting to watch inventories of cars. I have noticed driving around that there's some dealerships that have been stocking up in what I would consider to be extraordinary levels of inventory capability or presence. In my drives from the northwest corner to Fairfield County, Connecticut, which I do almost daily in some weeks, and it takes me down the New York Route 22, where there are two relatively big dealerships. One, the General Motors-based vehicle dealership, and Jay knows them as well, and the other one's a Mercedes dealership. The acres of lawn around the General Motors dealership on the right side of 22 have just—they're just now clogged with vehicles. Whether they're—and they're a combination of new stock and pre-owned stock and whatever else they happen to stock, which may be other makers' vehicles, which are often the case in all automotive dealerships where they are selling other automobiles of other makers' makes. And I wonder, Jay, and you might want to chime in on this. I don't know whether you think about it like I do, but I wonder how these dealerships can economically survive with these incredibly large holdings of vehicles, which I don't know much about automobile financing on the corporate side of things, but it's extraordinary to me that sales can progress at these dealerships at a rate that makes them very happy to have large inventories sitting on their around their buildings.
Well, I think, if I may barge in, I think it's, you know, historically it's been a trademark of the American
way of doing it,
model,
yes,
to have very large inventories. You know, and if we talk in terms of days of inventory, we're, you know, oftentimes in the 60 to 80 days average, which means cars sit 2 to 3 months on the lot before they get sold. Sometimes a lot more than that, others not. And which the number of days a car sits on the lot is really the metric as to how well
sales
that
are going.
Particular model is selling. You know, during the COVID era, you know, inventories went way, way down everywhere. I actually thought for a while that the whole industry might get smart and might align itself with what is done in other parts of the world or with other industries here and go on a build model. Whereas here, it's not at all the case. Manufacturers build a slew of cars and then shove them down the throats of dealers, who then have to find a way of selling them, of moving them. And yes, the finance charges are incredibly high and are baked in the price of the car. And with interest rates going up or having gone up, you know, in the last couple of years, I would think that that affects already the price of cars. Back to the situation of tariffs, I am wondering if dealers are not being slick on in this right now. I know people who have gone and traded in cars 3 to 4 months before their lease was up. And I don't think they had any intention of doing that necessarily, but I'm guessing that they must have brought the car in or got in the call from the dealer saying, hey, we'll give you a great price on your use on your car. Or we'll
buy you out of your lease and do all that stuff. Right?
Yeah. And now they're building they're getting rid of new inventory and also building used car inventory, as you know, many people think that if the price of cars goes up, the price of used cars will go up as well. Specifically, if we think that it seems likely, from what I've read anyway, that the tariffs will, if in fact they come into effect,
yes,
the tariffs will affect the lower price cars a lot more than higher end cars, because the lower end cars, you know, the more affordable cars of this world, whether it is from Ford or GM or other manufacturers, are the very cars that are built, whether in Mexico, in China, or you know, elsewhere where labor costs are lesser. So those cars will not only have tariffs on certain components like the engines when they're assembled in America, but on the entire car. So ironically, the cheaper cars are likely to suffer the most from tariffs. That's the bottom line. So I don't know. You know, the bottom line, I don't know where we go from there. I've talked to people just in the last couple of days.
Well, if I may. It's going to be a period of time before the tariff. If the dealers, the day the tariffs are actually announced, raise all their prices, and when something's wrong, somebody's taking your money and stealing. So
too, because I don't think the prices of existing inventory, in my view, should, if the people or the dealers are smart, should change at all over what they're now showing. If you drive through a lot,
no, absolutely not.
Vehicles have landed on the lots. Days to weeks to maybe a month before the date of April 2nd, which, depending on when this show is heard, will have either passed or being about to pass, tells us more about whether the tariffs have gone into effect or went into effect or not. But you're right, Mike.
Well, and any cars that are built in this country will probably stay at about the same, too. So.
No, they won't.
No, they won't, because the engines are built in Mexico for some of them, or Europe for some of them. Parts are built, and this is the problem that it's going to be. How the hell are they going to figure out how to price the vehicles they're selling, even if they're supposedly built in America, if the tariffs on the parts have gone into effect and they're built with parts that have been tariff affected? So you're right, Mike, on one point, but I don't think it's universally correct.
Okay, hold on, guys. I don't think we let Mike finish his point.
No, we didn't.
And Mike, go finish your point, because I have a counterpoint to this right away.
Well, no, it's, you know, all I wanted to point out was that the tariffs will not affect the prices now, shouldn't affect the prices now for months down the road. And even with the various components being made, a lot of it's going to be a big component versus small, because you have to have the whole wrap of the car. And all I've maintained is that inside of this country, one of the things that's supposed to drive this is to get us to manufacture more internally.
Correct.
And stop relying on the outside. I just think that over the time period, you won't see a dramatic change in the price of cars that are made totally in this country. On the outside ones, probably will down the road see a dramatic change. But I really think the car prices made in America exclusively will stay fairly level.
I totally disagree, and I'll tell you why. I'm not saying that they will or won't, but the trend will be on the rise, because the car manufacturers are not here for the good of the people, and certainly not for the good of the people who can't afford expensive cars. They're here to make money, and if the prices of cars generally go up, in whether it be because they're imported, you know, the medium or high-end cars, believe me, one way or another, for one reason or another, the lower price cars will go up too. There's no doubt in my mind.
Well, first of all, as of April 2nd, whenever the listeners hear this show, there will have been tariffs. There are already some tariffs imposed on steel, I believe. So that's already happened to possibly any imported steel that might be put into car production whenever those tariffs went into effect and whenever that steel arrived at the manufacturing bases and are put into the cars. So it is going to be a very, very complex thing to watch, Mike, Jay, and Robin. And we're going to be watching it to see just exactly what happens. I am not going to cruise through dealers' lots that I know of.
You are. You always do.
Well,
always
I don't. Do. Yeah, but I'm not going to go window sticker shopping and try to see if there are two Chevy or GMC Suburbans in there. One was built in March of this year, and another was built in April 15th of this year, and the sticker is markedly different for, let's say, a identically built vehicle, if you could ever find that situation. But we're going to see a higher price somewhere along the line, and I don't know when they're going to be eased in or where they're going to suddenly show up on new tractor trailers, lots of cars that drive into the dealer's driveways after April 2nd of 2025. It'll be something to watch and talk about. But you're right, Jay, I think the cars are going to become more expensive sooner rather than later, and it's going to cover all levels of vehicles, from entry-level cars all the way up to the luxury brands on both domestically produced vehicles and, of course, the imported ones. Jay, you want to talk about the Honda CR-V, and I was looking in one of my magazines about the 25 Honda Prologue, which brought me back to you and the CR-V, because you have recently driven a hybrid version of the CR-V. And as we know, we've been talking to our listeners, we are big fans of the hybrid level of electrical technology vehicles being produced, and they're the most popular versions of electric vehicles. So the hybrids have both gasoline engines and electric motors in them and don't have range issues and all that kind of thing. So go for it.
Speak for yourself about being a big fan of hybrids. I am not particularly...
Well, you're a diesel man, and we know that, but we're not going to try to convince you to drop the diesel viewpoint.
No, that's not the point. My point... anyway, but I did drive the newest 2025 Honda CR-V, so this is, I don't know if it's the fifth or sixth generation of Honda CR-V. And I'll get back to that in a second. But I drove pretty much back-to-back a 2022, which was one of the last of the previous generation of Honda CR-Vs. And that car had a 1.5-liter turbo engine, CVT transmission, was a higher-end model, had leather. And it really drove like a much more expensive car. This newer version elevates the CR-V to an entire new level. But it's very interesting, and I had done a little bit of reading, and I didn't really go back to read about the car. Basically, the engine it's now in the hybrid CR-V. It's a 2-liter non-turbocharged engine, just a plain 2-liter engine, with two electric motors that act, one on each axle, that drive the front and the rear wheels, and a battery pack. So basically, the engine generates the power, and the power goes to the electric motors, which in turn drive the wheels. It's interesting because if you run it in econ mode, although it is not a plug-in hybrid, the car will start and run like a generator for maybe 5 or 10 seconds, so at a high idle, and then all of a sudden turn off, and then you're riding on no engine for maybe, I don't know, a quarter of a mile, then the engine goes on. And the engine pretty much runs at very low RPM. There's actually no tachometer in the car, so you actually don't know what the RPMs of the engine are. But the engine is much quieter than in the previous generations, and that's another, you know, plush thing or attribute, if you will, of the new CR-V. And it's really interesting. It just does everything really well, although it'll do bizarre things, like the engine will all of a sudden kick up if the battery is running low on power. The engine will kick off when you least expect it and run at very high RPMs for maybe a few 5 or 10 seconds. But it does not affect the speed of the car in any way. Very interesting. It is one of the favorites of all the car magazines. Interestingly, the Honda CR-V that actually came out, the first model came out in, I think, 1997 or 1998, has never been like the top number one small SUV. It has never been the top selling small SUV. It's always been in the top three, top five vehicles. But I don't think, I read quickly, and I don't recall it ever being the number one choice. But it does everything really, really well at a price that is substantially lower than luxury small SUVs or just bigger SUVs. Anyway, that's so much for the CR-V. As I said, I think it's a sixth or seventh generation. I remember driving for maybe we had a 2003 second generation CR-V. And I always thought the fit and finish on that car was unbelievable. It just was very, very good for the price level of the car at the time. But again, it's a Honda. So that's my little take on the CR-V.
Scout is a topic of conversation, which I'll bring up right now, because Scout is about to show up in the country as the reinvention of the International Scout Harvester. Now, trademark is now owned by the Volkswagen Group, and they have taken over the design and getting ready to ship vehicles towards our country to be sold. And this is where the point of contention is coming up, apparently, like Teslas, bypassing the dealership, the VW dealerships, as a way, as a source or a location where you could buy the Scout. And apparently, there's a lot of opposition. I'm trying to find the story by an organization is in, the National Automobile Dealers Association, who thinks VW is going down the wrong path to try to sell this outside dealers. Jay, do you have a comment about how you think it should be sold?
No, I just think it's a niche vehicle. We're making a lot of noise about just another
new
modern
electric vehicle,
retro vehicle, incorporating new technology. And let's see where the dust settles. It's not gonna sell in
great
in
numbers,
crazy numbers, but I do have to say, the whole idea of selling outside of dealer networks is a trend that Tesla started, 10, almost 15 years ago now, and it's a constant battle fighting all the franchise laws, and it's a way of Volkswagen trying to get into that groove, I guess. So it's an experiment. We'll see where it goes. It'd probably be a cool vehicle.
It is a very interesting looking vehicle. I hope there are a lot of older listeners listening to our show who will remember what the old International Scouts looked like and were like. One of the features I'm really fascinated by is they're going to put a bench seat option into the Scout for the front seat. So if you go on a date and you want to have a close proximity of your date in the car, you no longer will have a console in between the two seats if you get the bench seat option. Who knows what might happen then?
Robin, most listeners don't remember the days of the bench seat.
I know, I'm saying, if we had any.
And in this day and age, that would not be considered a very safe thing. And I don't think you're going to see, I don't think you're about to see bench seats with lap belts only and little pseudo headrest.
Our listeners are laughing hardly. I can hear them in the background.
Okay. Yep. And you put two hands on the wheel, and you don't put your hand on the top of the wheel.
Okay, Jay, that's a very good point. You bring up a good point about two hands on the wheel.
I'm glad.
Where are you in all full-time auto driving without any need to put your hands on the wheel?
Okay, so I thought you were going to say, when I'm using the wheel, where do I put my hands? I think hand position is a very important thing.
Our listeners are going to have a good time with this show.
So I'll start with that. Before we get into the zero-hand steering wheel and the stupidity of a Tesla yoke, by the way,
right.
Let's talk about where, for safety reasons, where is the best position to put your hands? And I'll ask you, Robin, first, where do you put your hands on the wheel?
No, it's interesting. I've paid some attention to that situation. I think I have my hands more or less at the quarter of and quarter after on the clock face location on the steering wheel. It changes rather frequently. Sometimes I find it my left hand is down at the, the 20 of the hour location. When I'm sort of relaxed and driving along an interstate, I look forward to a critical report comment, Jay, if you have it on that. Where do you think
you
it should be at any speeds, or should it be consistently located at all speeds for emergency needs?
I think it's 2 and 10, isn't it?
Well, now it should be 9 and 3, and it can be 2 and 10. I honestly think it really depends where the wheel is relative to your seating position.
Well,
so a lot of simulator racing, and I have fake steering wheels that are very heavy to drive. And I've moved my hands on the wheels to try to figure out where's the most efficient way to be with my hands on the wheel. And sometimes it's having your palms a little lower than a 9-3 position. But that's if the steering wheel is a little higher. If the steering wheel is a little lower, you're probably going to be more at 10-2. You don't want to be at 11-1. You don't want your wheel to be yo-yoing from one side to the other. You should have two hands on the wheel. I've done a little bit of driver coaching, and people look at me a little funny, but I'll have student drivers hold the wheel with one hand,
yep,
just to make them feel what they're actually doing with each one of the hands. So if you're turning one way, are you pulling the wheel down or are you pushing the wheel up with the other hand?
All good points. This is interesting.
And the driver coach made me think of that 15 years ago, and I was like, huh, I've never thought of that. And now I try to be more conscious of what I do with the steering wheel. I do think if you're on the highway and you're very relaxed, if you're on, I'm right now in Florida. There's a lot of traffic here in southern Florida, but as I go northward and I'm going on big open stretches of road, I may relax my hands a little bit on the wheel, but you know, you really should have two hands on the wheel most of the time. What you don't want to have is your hand, one hand like we used to drive, right? With let's say the left hand at 9 o'clock and the right hand on top of the wheel at 12 o'clock.
Right.
Because if you do get into a crash and the airbag blows, that's the way you're holding your wheel, you will both break your hand and your nose, and they're both pretty painful and for no good reason. So you want your hands to be out of the airbag trajectory. That's another way of looking at it.
Okay. Well, I don't want to tell you that I'm looking at other oncoming drivers, because that is an unsafe thing to do when you're driving, to see where their hands might be. I will say that when I'm in a traffic clogged situation, maybe going along in a line of traffic, I may glance at somebody, and I've got two lanes going each way, and this can happen on something like the Merritt Parkway at rush hour when traffic's moving at 10 to 15 miles an hour because it's clogged. I have seen, I don't do it deliberately, but I have noticed that people sometimes have their hands at the 12 o'clock position on the wheel, and at moving at 5 miles an hour, that may be something. But I often see one-handed drivers, and you can guess what the other hand is holding as they are driving. And they're not doing this just because they're only going 5 miles an hour. They're doing this at 75 miles an hour, and that's the ubiquitous cell phone. When they're not on, you know, Bluetooth connected situations, and they're texting.
Yeah, well, hopefully, the things like Android and CarPlay are getting more commonly used nowadays. But you're right; we still see a lot of people. But when they're not holding their phones, they're also sipping their coffee. So
Yeah. Yeah, they're also sipping their coffee, they're also looking down, not necessarily out the windshield.
Or they're trying to navigate a screen that has all the functions of the car, and trying to figure out how the car how to make the ventilation or the radio work.
Well, we're getting and I'm sure we might sort of chime in and say we're almost at the end. But these are lots of sort of safety tidbits to sit there and make people think about, because all those things you just pointed out all contribute to not properly being fully attentive to driving.
So back to the steering wheel for 2 seconds.
Okay.
And because I drive a lot of car and I move, a lot of people probably are not even aware that you can actually move the steering wheel up or down and
that
forward and backwards on the column. And I think it's a very important feature. One of the most important things in safe driving is driving position. So you want to be in a comfortable position. And the first thing you do is adjust, obviously, the length of your leg. Not everybody is the same, right? So adjust the distance of the seat to the pedals, the height. The height can be different for shorter and taller people. And then your angle, your back rest,
back.
Back seat angle, and then adjust the steering wheel up and down and forward and backwards.
And
you
it's usually a lever that's down underneath the column, out of sight of being easily seen, so you have to feel around for it. And it's a lever most in many cars. Some of the luxury cars are electric, and you push the button up or down. One of my Audis is the Audi is that way, and it'll move up or down. It doesn't move left or right. It just moves up and down. And I think, Jay, I don't know where the proper distance is between the chest of a driver and a steering wheel should be, but you see people, and they're usually short, very short people, right up hunched on their wheel.
Well, those are the people who should push the steering wheel forward. But
yeah.
By the same token, you also want to be able to reach, if you want to be able to grab the top of the steering wheel with your hand.
Right.
And kind of still have a little more open than 90 degrees, maybe 120 degree angle at your elbow level. I know we're getting a little technical here, but it is important. I've actually focused on that a lot in the last few years that I've been driving and coaching, and it makes for safer driving.
Well, is one of the first things you do when you're driving other people's cars is to adjust the wheel to your needs, and then reset it for the owner?
I will move the wheel. I usually try to move the wheel back in the position, because mirrors and wheels,
they're preset for the driver.
Find that people will put them back in the position that they had them initially.
Yeah.
So it bothers my mind. But, if I've driven your car, please not only readjust your seat, but your steering wheel and your mirrors.
I think we are Car Keys for this week with Jay, Mike, and Robin.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, RobinHoodRadio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.